Welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim Galante along with Jeff Byers. Jeff, it's been a few days. Have you absorbed, finally, that Penn State Bowling Green game, especially that first half?
I have. I've dealt with it. And I'll tell you what really helped me deal with it, Jim, was watching Northern Illinois and Notre Dame. Because, man, was that fun to watch. A lot more fun than watching that Bowling Green Penn State contest. I can assure you that.
I've been saying all week, thank goodness for Notre Dame. We get out of a game with a win, okay? It's one thing to get a scare and come out of it with a W. It's a whole nother thing to end up with the loss to a MAC team. And here's a stat that I have thrown out a couple times this week, Jeff. Do you know that Marcus Freeman, in his only couple years at Notre Dame, he's already lost three times at home when he was at least a 16.5-point favorite?
Wow. That'll get you some trouble with the alumni, that's for sure.
It sure will. And I think Marcus Freeman has really gotten a pass from the media until now.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, Jim, and I think this is sometimes difficult for a lot of us to differentiate, right? Like, it's easy to root, for me at least, against Brian Kelly. Like, I don't like the personality, I don't like the demeanor, but I think you have to grudgingly concede, dude's a pretty good coach. Marcus Freeman is an eminently likable human being. Everything I've read about him, everything I know about him, and certainly the way he comes across, man, it's easy to root for that guy. But there is a difference, and we talked about this a little bit on our Goon and Ironhead show this week. There's a difference, and it's a pretty significant difference, between being a good coach, having a good football mind, and I think Marcus Freeman checks off both of those boxes, and being an effective head coach. And I think sometimes we generally that cover football or follow football as fans or media members don't maybe fully appreciate all that is involved with being a good head coach. And I don't know where the deficiency is with Marcus Freeman. I'm not close enough to that program to be able to give any insight as to where the problems lie. But again, it's not, I think Marcus Freeman knows football and I think he builds great relationships. I don't think that's where the issue is. Being a head coach is an entirely different animal. Yep, you need to have the good football mind. You need to have the good relationships, but you have to have a remarkable degree of organization and also a really good ability to delegate and know where and how to delegate and to compartmentalize hey, this time of the day, I do recruiting and just recruiting. This time of the day, I do game planning and game planning only. Here, I have a little time to maybe, meet with the family. Here, I have to get together with the leaders on the team. There is a lot that is involved with it, and that's not even to mention nowadays. I mean, you're meeting with alumni groups. You have to be staying in touch with the parents and the families of your kids so that everybody's on the same page, so that you're trying to keep as many of the kids that you want to keep, so that the transfer portal isn't becoming a big issue in the negative for your program. And you have to at least have a pretty solid awareness and understanding of what's happening with your NIL stuff and that things are being taken care of properly there. So there's a whole lot that goes on. And I know, James Franklin, sometimes people use it negatively that he's a CEO of Penn State and they mean it to be disparaging. And I'm telling you, you better be a CEO in this day and age in particular. You better know everything that's going on to a degree, have a good understanding of who's doing what, and still be able to keep your hands involved pretty directly on, okay, this is from the football perspective, what all we're doing and what I need to do. But again, there's about seven or eight other critically important components above and beyond the football aspect that you better have at least a very good handle on if you're a head coach. And again, I have no idea where the breakdown is with Marcus Freeman, but I clearly, as a head coach, and it's not to say he can't become a great head coach, but something needs to change there in the way he's approaching things and the way he's doing things. And again, I have no idea what it is, but yeah, three losses at home when you're that kind of a favorite and you have the resources and everything else with Notre Dame, it's not enough to just be liked by the players. And I think clearly Marcus Freeman is liked by the players. There's just a whole lot more that goes into that.
And the CEO idea, Jeff, is there because you're dealing with a $100 million business, okay, with a major football program. And to use James Franklin in comparison now to Marcus Freeman, they were both in situations where they were in a dogfight with a team that they had absolutely no excuse for losing or even playing a close game. And I think we need to give James Franklin some credit, not to take away from how poorly his defense played in the first half, but they made the adjustment at halftime and came back and won that game, which has not always been the case for James Franklin. He has lost in the past games that he should not have lost based on talent. That does seem to be a hurdle for coaches. And at least based on the last couple seasons, James Franklin has crossed that hurdle.
Yeah. And I think there's a couple of other things that I would throw into the hopper in terms of looking at those two situations in particular from this past Saturday, Penn State and Notre Dame. One is, and I understand Penn State fans and Notre Dame fans are going to be spending the majority of their time being critical, and understandably and rightfully so, of their programs and their team's performances. But I'm telling you, Jim, I really was impressed with what Bowling Green came out and did offensively in that first half. Yep, Penn State did not play to the level that you need Penn State to play if it's to get where it wants to go this season. But I also think you had a veteran quarterback and a veteran offensive line that has played together now for a few years and has clearly a very good understanding of what it is trying to accomplish. And I think in both of those games, while it is fair to be critical of Penn State and Notre Dame, I really do think it is okay to at least acknowledge, man, that was a heck of a coaching job by both Bowling Green and by Northern Illinois. And those two teams came out ready to play, had an excellent game plan, and executed it in both cases to near perfection. At the end of the day, what to me, I guess two separators for Penn State. One is they did make the adjustments. I know, and I think it's a fair criticism, how come it took till halftime to make those adjustments, but the adjustments were made and they came out and controlled it much better, much, much better in the second half. But also, if you're looking at the difference, why Penn State ended up winning their game and Notre Dame lost its game, certainly that is a component, the adjustments. But also, Penn State had really good quarterback play from a veteran quarterback. Notre Dame, not so much. And I know sometimes it feels like we're oversimplifying it, and we are, but quarterback play is such a huge component in terms of your team's or your program's ability to have a chance to really be able to accomplish what your team is trying to do. In the case of Penn State and Notre Dame, trying to get to the college football playoffs. And if you don't have that consistently good play at that position in particular, it is really, really hard to overcome that.
it really is. And I'm glad you brought up the quarterback play also at from Bowling Green. Connor Bazelak, he's a grown-up. He's not a kid anymore. This is his sixth year. So he's got to be 23, 24 years old, okay? And let's not forget he has Southeast Conference and Big Ten experience.
Yes.
So this moment's not going to be too big for him. And he was exceptional. And I was looking for my stat sheet, which I keep setting aside and losing. But he was, I know in the first half, he completed 80% of his passes. Okay.
Yep.
He also, the vast majority of his passes were from 0 to 9 yards. And I think the number for the full game in that range, he was 17 for 22. That tells you not only that he was accurate, but it tells you what the game plan was and how well they executed it, Jeff.
Yeah, and I think it's a smart game plan, right? You don't want to give Penn State's defensive line a chance to be the difference maker. And if you're getting rid of the ball quickly and you have a veteran quarterback that knows, all right, this is where my players are going to be, boom, 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 those are my checkdowns. If it's not there, throw it away. But chances are, again, on those quick hitters, somebody's going to be open enough that if you are an accurate quarterback, and Bazelak certainly was accurate, at least on Saturday, you're going to be able to pick up some yardage. And again, I thought the game plan for Bowling Green was terrific, and I thought the execution was fantastic. But what allowed that is, yeah, it's a MAC school, but again, a veteran quarterback and a veteran and probably by Big Ten standards, underrated offensive line. Again, I don't know that it's a Bowling Green team that's going to go in there and push around Ohio State if it was given the opportunity, but I think that's a pretty good, and I know it's a very veteran offensive line, and they did, a great job of knowing what it was they wanted to accomplish and going out and executing the game plan, I think, as well as they possibly could have on Saturday.
There's no doubt this was not all on the Penn State defense playing poorly, which, by the way, they did. Okay. They did play poorly, but this was also Bowling Green doing an excellent job. It's going to be interesting to kind of keep an eye on them, Jeff, through the rest of the season and see what they do and how well they play in the MAC conference. I don't know the MAC conference that well. I don't know if they were predicted to win it. I think they were predicted to be second, third, somewhere in there. We shall see. I do want to pick up one of the things that you said when we get back right after this short break. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, Enjoy Cafe Tea pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
It's quarter number two on the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number two. He's Jeff Byers. I'm Jim Galante. We are talking Penn State football and college football in general, starting with the Penn State Bowling Green game. And Jeff, you were talking about not just the veteran quarterback that Bowling Green had, but also the veteran offensive line. And one of our co-hosts on the show is Dustin Schutte. He's a Big Ten writer for Sports Illustrated. And he brought up, I thought was a very good point, and I want to get your take on it, is that the question of maybe in college football, maybe, just maybe, we're getting a little bit of that same thing we get in the college basketball tournament, which is the Kentuckys and the Dukes. They get the one-and-done players. Some of these smaller schools, they may not have NBA-caliber players, but they stick around. And you might get that veteran team that they played together for 3 or 4 years, and it's tough for the 18-year-olds, no matter how talented they are, to win there. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be to that level, but maybe that's what we're seeing a little bit, where the transfer portal brings some players up. It also does the reverse, where you can get a Bazelak who is not at Missouri anymore, not even at Indiana anymore, but here he is at Bowling Green, a really experienced quarterback. And maybe we're seeing that throughout the country. I also mentioned Kyle McCord going from Ohio State to Syracuse. And all of a sudden, he's giving Syracuse a fighting chance. Is that happening in the college game?
Yeah, I think there will be some of that. And I do think this Bowling Green team is a great example of that. And again, we talk about, so I think if you can keep a core group of players, and you're, again, we're talking about some of the smaller Power 4, Power 5 programs. I don't know if the Pac-12 is making this comeback that's heralded or not, but whatever. Or some of these, you know, smaller conferences like the MAC. Yeah, I do think if you can get, again, a good core group of players and then get that dynamic wide receiver or running back or certainly quarterback, and quarterback is, again, the kind of the key to the whole thing here for any of these programs, is that you at least need really good quarterback play. But yeah, I think that's a good point, and I do think we'll see some more of that. As a quick aside, can I just tell you that as fascinating as I think the storylines are, and there are a ton of fascinating storylines in the Big Ten and the SEC, I do think the most fascinating wide open race in college football this year is the ACC. I know Miami looks like they're coming out gangbusters, and maybe they'll end up running away with it. I have my doubts about that with Miami, but it feels to me like there are at least seven programs that could make a real run right now, that it feels here as we go into this weekend, that there are at least seven programs that it's like, oh man, I could see them going on a run here and being in an ACC title game and matching up there.
Do you know what's interesting, Jeff, is as you were setting that up with, you know, here's a storyline, here's a league, I thought you were going to say the Big 12, because I think it's a similar storyline.
I think you're right. I think the ACC has even more teams just because of but you may be right. I guess I haven't looked real carefully at the Big 12, but after watching what Illinois did with Kansas and seeing some of the other results, maybe there's as many teams there that could be vying for that type of an opportunity. But boy, it just, yeah, maybe both of those conferences are seem at least, feel at this point of the season, pretty wide open.
And Jeff, you know, I like to pat myself on the back, okay? You do know that, right?
I do, and I'm right there with you in terms of patting my own back. I don't necessarily want to pat you on the back.
I'm well aware of that also, but the discussion during this offseason was so much about how going from a 4-team playoff to a 12-team playoff would diminish the regular season. And I kept saying, no, I think it's just the opposite. It's going to make so many more games important. And it's also going to make the conferences, the ACC and the Big 12, I think a lot of people, and rightfully so, diminish them. You lose Texas and Oklahoma, you can't be the same kind of conference. Let's face it, Clemson is down, and obviously Florida State is. But there's still a bye that's out there for the champion of the ACC and the Big 12. And you mentioned you thought there's, you know, seven teams maybe in the ACC who are in the battle. I'll say there's at least five in the Big 12 battle. That's a heck of a lot of teams who are going to be in it to the end, without even mentioning, we were talking earlier about Notre Dame, and I hear folks say, oh, they're eliminated from the playoffs. You can't make the playoffs if you lost to a MAC team. Guess what? They have a winnable schedule the rest of the way, Jeff. An 11-1 Notre Dame team is in the playoffs.
No question whether they should be or not, but yes, they're in, no question.
Yeah, I don't want to say I don't care, I do, but the fact is every game they play, and I believe it's their last game of the year that they play USC,
yep,
that could be a play-in game for the playoffs, okay? There are so many games now that become more interesting. After Michigan got schooled by Texas, we're just a couple weeks away from Michigan playing USC. Now, that all of a sudden becomes a major playoff implication game. Yeah. So in my mind, this 12-team playoff is the best thing to happen to college football.
Couldn't agree more. Wish it would have happened decades ago. But yes, I for all of those reasons and more, I just think the and you see it in other sports. I mean, it's not hard to figure out. The more fan bases you have that have a rooting interest later and later in the season, the more exciting your product is, and the more those fans are watching all of the games and all of the results and seeing all of the implications of each result. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, to me, easy common sense that, yeah, you want more teams involved because it means that those races become more significant and you get more eyeballs to the TV sets or to the streams these days as well that are interested in what's happening all throughout the country.
Let's circle back to the Penn State game and the Penn State scare. One of the things that I was thinking about, it wasn't just Penn State, it was Oregon also got a scare. Alabama had a scare. And obviously Notre Dame lost, so that's like four of the top 10 teams that got a scare. And it's interesting, Penn State really didn't move in the rankings in the top 10, despite the scare. Are we kind of, though, reaching a point in college football where you don't need the style point so much, just win?
Yeah, and I do think eventually we're going to get to the place where that's going to be even more so, because I do think at some point here we're going to have something similar to the NFL in terms of the scheduling being handled by more of a central office. There seems to be a growing sentiment for it, and I think a growing movement toward that. And I think that'll be good for the game as well, because I think you'll have fewer. I think you'll still have some of these matchups. And listen, Notre Dame scheduling Northern Illinois because they're thinking they're getting the win and the paycheck. Same thing with Penn State and Bowling Green. So, you know, it's not always something you can take for granted. But, you know, what gets you more intrigued about, hey, I want to see a matchup, even if it's Penn State, West Virginia, right? Like nobody was thinking that was going to be the marquee game of the year in college football, but it got your attention. It's like, oh, this is better. This will be fun to see this type of matchup. And I think that's what the sport wants. And we can argue about whether it needs it, but I think it's going to be better for the sport if we get more of those matchups. Again, it doesn't all have to be, you know, Texas, Michigan matchups, but more of the matchups that, hey, let's see, an Illinois taking on a Tennessee. Let's see, and pick any two schools. But I mean, get more of those matchups with teams that are with those power conferences that at least you feel like, man, this is a game that more fans are going to want to check out ahead of time just because of the intrigue of the matchup.
I've always feel, Jeff, that they should make it require 9 conference games so you don't have that disparity.
Yes.
And then you've got 3 out-of-conference games. Look, you're allowed 1 cupcake so you could get an extra home game. And then you've got to play 2 Power 4, Power 5 teams. And again, it doesn't mean you have to schedule Georgia, like you said.
Right.
For Penn State, scheduling West Virginia, scheduling Auburn.
Yep.
Scheduling Pitt, just to bring in a different team, I think will create the interest from the fan base.
Yeah, I mean, you want to create more challenging opportunities than Pitt, but
You just couldn't help yourself, could you?
I really couldn't. I'm sorry. Pitt did whip up on Cincinnati, if you missed it this last weekend. 28-27 would be your final in that one, but Pitt did win it.
That they did, and I think they had to make a big comeback in the end to get there.
Yeah.
But to your point, you're right, and I joked with someone, yeah, who wants to see these matchups against a MAC team? They're never competitive, are they?
Penn State doesn't want to see it.
Well, hopefully things will go a little better against Kent State than it did Bowling Green. But it's now, when we get back for our next segment, I do want to talk to you a little bit about the actual game itself. You know, we sang James Franklin's praises for not falling victim like Marcus Freeman and Notre Dame did. You know, when they're in a dogfight, James Franklin and his team, they found a way to win the game, okay? Credit for that. But the fact is, and Bowling Green played well, and Connor Bazelak had a heck of a game. All credit to them. But there is no way in the world that this Penn State team, and specifically this Penn State defense, should have been behind Bowling Green at halftime. Just should not have been, Jeff. When we come back, I want to ask you some of the specifics of that, not just what went right on the Bowling Green side of it, what went wrong on the Penn State side. I'm going to ask Jeff that when we come back. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Let's get back to the action on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim. He's Jeff. I gave you some time there, Jeff, between segments to think about your answer to my question about the defense. But before we get there, for a totally different reason, I asked you a question during our break. And I talked about stalling with something. I made reference to going into the four corners. And I asked you the question, how old do you have to be to understand a reference to the four corners?
That is a good question. I guess kids in their 20s probably wouldn't, I mean, unless they're really studying the history of the game, probably would not know it. I don't know. That's a good question. Somewhere in the 30s or 40s, their current age, I guess you probably wouldn't know anything about the four corners and probably wouldn't have any idea what we're even talking about. What strategy are you talking about?
Use your Google basketball four corners and you'll know what we're talking about. All right. I stalled long enough for you, Jeff. I went into four corners long enough for you to think about it. And my question was, what actually went wrong on the Penn State side of the ball, on the defensive side? Because this is not the Penn State defense that we had grown to love over the last couple seasons.
No, for sure. And by the way, be grateful, you young listeners out there, that you don't have to watch the four corners and what that is all about these days. It was not an easy watch, that is for sure. As far as from the Penn State defensive perspective, I think if I'm targeting the one area, I think the linebacker play, and I think the fact that they got Abdul Carter more involved in the linebacker play in the second half tells you that's kind of what they zeroed in on as being a problem area against Bowling Green. You know, to some degree, I guess you would take issue with the defensive line in the secondary as well. Defensive line not getting home, But again, when the quarterback is releasing the ball in two and a half seconds, that's I don't care how quick you are off the line of scrimmage. That's an awfully tall ask of your defensive line to get home. Now, could you interrupt? And we saw, you know, Carter batted that one pass down in, I forget now if that was third or early fourth quarter. And yeah, I mean, could they have had more of an impact? Nonetheless, sure. And I do think that there were some missed tackles for sure in the secondary, although I'm not sure. I mean, I listened to a couple of folks like immediately after the game, and I haven't gone back and looked. Maybe they're right and I'm wrong. It didn't feel like Penn State was just missed tackles left and right. I'm not saying they made all the tackles and made all the plays they should, but at least as I was watching, it felt more like Bowling Green was just taking the chunk yardage that was given to them and doing a good job with that. So, I mean, I think all three layers of the defense can bear some responsibility. I think the Winston injury obviously doesn't help things, but I mean, we've been talking all, I think rightfully so, all preseason and early season about the tremendous depth that Penn State has across the board and in the secondary and at the safety position in particular. So, you know, it's hard for me to buy that. Well, yeah, if Winston was out there, boy, they would have shut Bowling Green down. I don't think you can really make that argument. And to be honest, the most surprising part for me wasn't, I mean, I was surprised with Bowling Green's ability to move the ball, but I was borderline stunned at their ability to finish off the drives. Like West Virginia was able to get some yardage between the 20s, and then Penn State would step up, either make a turnover or make a stop. Bowling Green just, again, that first half, not only putting points on the board, it was getting to the end zone, getting it home. And again, very impressed by Bowling Green. I think that the linebacker play was probably the biggest disappointment, at least for me, in looking at that first half. But I also think that's the area where they made the most difference in terms of the play from the first half to the second half, where the linebackers seemed to get more involved and make more altering plays in a positive way for Penn State.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things there. The KJ Winston question, he was actually in at the start of the game when Bowling Green was moving the ball.
Came right down, yep.
And he wasn't in there in the second half when the Penn State defense played much better. So I think you could take that off the table.
Yes.
I probably am more critical than you are of the tackling. I didn't think that was very crisp. Now, of course, it came after, you know, a completion that you often saw the Bowling Green receivers running away from the Penn State linebackers or safety. So again, credit to the design and criticism to the Penn State's defensive coverage. But the other part that was interesting was James Franklin. He addressed the tackling, but he also talked about the inability to communicate, that they had some issues with the helmet. And I would have normally said that sounds like an excuse. And it still does sound like an excuse, but it looked like the Penn State defense was disorganized as Bowling Green was coming to the line of scrimmage. So Penn State felt like they were a step slow getting started on the plays. And I wonder if, are we going to have to reach a point where we tell the crowd to be quiet when your team's on defense?
Hopefully it doesn't come to that, because I think the impact that can have on disrupting an offense is pretty significant. And yeah, you would think that they have the communication component, because if it goes out, you've obviously got to have, and I understand then both teams and I get the rules, but I mean, you've got to have things in place that if the communication does go out, you're ready to go and operate anyway. And to be honest with you, at least to me, you ought to be able to kind of figure it out anyway if you're Penn State, especially after that first drive. Again, first drive, Bowling Green comes out, boom, boom, boom. Very good. Get to the sideline. Hey, we've got to do this or that. And again, I don't have enough expertise to tell you, but by gosh, we should have been in the two gap instead of the three gap. Let's shift over. But like you would think the players would be communicating to the coaches, all right, let's make this adjustment here. I think we can get in on this side. And so that probably was the biggest disappointment to me, is that it took the halftime adjustments to make those adjustments. I would have thought, given, and I still think Tom Allen is an elite coordinator. I used that term last week, but I think it's fair to say that you would think an elite coordinator, with or without the communication issues, would say, all right, these are the adjustments we have to make from one drive to the next, especially against a team that, again, while I am giving Bowling Green its proper due, and I think it deserves its proper due, it does not have the athleticism or the number of high-quality athletes that Penn State does. And at some point, you got to be able to line up and just let your team, which has the better athletes, go win the battle. And Penn State, again, ultimately did that, but really did not seemingly make the necessary adjustments or the good enough adjustments in that first half to ever really put a dent in what Bowling Green was trying to do.
There's no doubt the rest of the teams on the Penn State schedule are going to look at this game plan, going to look at what Bowling Green did. My question to you is, how much do you think future opponents can take from this and learn from this and exploit the Penn State defense?
Yeah, I'll be curious to see, one, what I don't know that we're going to learn much of anything from Kent State. I get it's another MAC opponent, but this is kind of the other end of the spectrum for the MAC. Kent State is going to struggle to find a win in its conference, let alone in college football this year. So I think regardless of what they try or don't try to do, I'm not sure we're going to learn much there. But the game that – and to be honest with you, I've kind of had it circled since the season – before the season began, which is just that Brett Bielema now, I think, has what he wants to do implemented at Illinois. And the one thing Brett Bielema does is get his offensive line in particular, but both lines, to play hard and to play well. And I do think we saw with Bowling Green that quick hitting – and I watched a little bit of that Illinois-Kansas game, and Illinois' passing game came up big, came up really big for them. And I wonder what adjustments Penn State will make, but I think Illinois looks at Bowling Green, it's going to look at that film and say, all right, there's the game plan. Let's go to the short passes, try to set up, take our shots here and there long. You know, certainly take a couple of whacks at it with the running game. But I think that short passing game, which was really effective for Bowling Green, is something that a team like Illinois, I mean, they're going to look at it and say, well, we have better personnel than Bowling Green, certainly. And we can go in there and hammer away. And if Bowling Green can keep it to a touchdown, we ought to be able to find a way to win it.
So what does Penn State do in response to that, Jeff?
Yeah, I'll be curious to see. I think there's a couple of things in terms of the way they change up. So let me back up. I do think Penn State went into this with the idea that we can win it with a vanilla defense. I don't think they pulled out all the stops in the second half, but I think they clearly switched some things up, and it's like, all right, we're not just going to go with one. And I'm not saying they went with one look the entire first half, but I do think they clearly mixed some things up. I think they need to, and I think they will with Illinois. It's going to be, and moving forward, it's going to be more of a week to week. And we've talked about this, I think, a bit before, Jim, which is I do think this defense, with the personnel it has, can attack different offenses differently with each of the three groups. So I think Penn State can maybe drop some guys like Abdul Carter into coverage instead of rushing them. And I'm not saying constantly, but I'm saying, you know, pick your spots here where it's okay, we're going to throw a different wrinkle in here. Blitz the linebackers maybe a little differently. I think there's some things you can do just schematically to keep it mixed up and keep offenses a little more off guard.
Hopefully we'll see that, Jeff. We've got one more quarter to go. Stay tuned. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
We head to the home stretch in quarter number four on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Brought to you by the Keystone Sports Network. Get the best Penn State sports news and analysis at KeystoneSportsNetwork.com or download the Keystone Sports app from your smartphone.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number four. He's Jeff. I'm Jim. We're talking Penn State football. And we're talking about the Penn State defense, which obviously struggled in the first half against Bowling Green. And the question became, what are we looking for going forward? Tell you what, Jeff, as I was sitting there through the first half, I was thinking, boy, we could use a little Manny Diaz blitzes and craziness just to upset the offense.
Yeah, and I think you will see more of that as the season progresses. Again, maybe they took this game a little too much for granted. At least that's I'm going to go with that. And again, I don't think it's necessarily that they weren't respecting Bowling Green. I just don't think they thought going in. And I think, and I would have said that's the right strategy. This is a team you ought to be able to just outman with your athleticism and not have to, you know, play a lot of guessing games with, you know, disguising what you're doing and everything. But I do think, again, it was a veteran offensive line for Bowling Green. And they clearly came in and knew exactly what they wanted to do, how they wanted to go about it. And they did a great job of executing it. I do think you're going to see a lot, and especially, listen, they have 3 weeks now to take what they learned from West Virginia and Bowling Green, look at the personnel they have, kind of figure out, all right, these are the matchups we want to expose if we get them in different games throughout the season. So I guess I just have enough faith in Tom Allen, what I think he brings to the table with his defensive schemes, that this is going to be looked at the end of the season as, yeah, boy, that was a rough half, but one rough half in a long season, not a big deal. And certainly that's obviously what all Penn State fans are hoping for. But, you know, I guess I guess maybe we'll find out more with that Illinois game, because I do think Illinois has a really good offensive line, and I was impressed with their quarterback against Kansas. And again, I didn't watch the whole game. I'm kind of seeing some highlights, so I guess it's hard to say. I can't sit here and definitively tell you that, boy, he was just on target all day, but he made some big throws in the clutch for sure. But he also had time to make those throws, and I do think, you know, Penn State's got a and I think they will mix some things up and bring different looks, different blitz packages from different places as the season goes along. I think that will happen, probably not against Kent State. I don't even know that you need to show anything in that one. But after that, I think this defense will be fine when it's all said and done.
Yeah. Kent State's a MAC team. We don't need to worry about them, Jeff.
Nobody has to sweat the MAC.
I'm looking at schedule. I always, in doing the show, I bring up the Big Ten schedule, because there's always some fascinating things. And I was thinking about, okay, Illinois-Penn State is the next game that there should be any concern with. And Illinois, they have Nebraska at Nebraska the week prior to playing Penn State.
Yes.
We'll find out a lot about Illinois prior to them getting to Happy Valley.
No doubt.
Let's get a little bit to the offensive side of the ball. And it was interesting hearing James Franklin this week in his press conference when he was asked about distribution of the football. And far be it for me to agree wholeheartedly with James Franklin, but I'm going to this time, okay? And it was asked about, you know, Julian Fleming, Liam Clifford getting passes. And, yeah, I'd like to see him get the ball. But Penn State threw the ball so infrequently. Here's a fun fact for you, Jeff. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Do you know that Connor Bazelak threw more passes against Penn State than Drew Aller did in his first two games combined?
Is that right? I did not know that.
And so when you talk about the lack of opportunities, there it is. It's almost as if you could combine Penn State's receiver statistics from the first two games into one game to compare, because Drew Aller has thrown a total of 37 passes over these two games. For a lot of teams, that's one game.
But Jim, how many times have we had the discussion and you hear it from fans? Why are you throwing to the tight end so much? Why do you keep him so involved, Jim? Oh, wait, no, nobody ever says that. Yeah, listen, I'm with you. I don't have a problem with what they've done the first two games with the passing game. But I think it is certainly fair to say that it is still just not known whether or not this team has anybody beyond Trey Wallace that you can count on. I think Amari Evans has been terrific, save for the one drop, but it was one big drop. And again, over the course of a season, can you allow a drop for a receiver? Of course. Not the end of the world, not a big deal, but it's one through two games. And if you're, and right now, it certainly appears that Amari Evans is your number two receiver. That's, you don't want that from your number two receiver. So again, to me, we just don't, there's just not enough on the table yet. We don't have enough of a sample size to be able to accurately assess the overall play of the receivers. And so it's just, again, an unknown. I don't think it's necessarily a problem area, but you certainly can't sit here if you're a Penn State fan and say definitively you have confidence that that part of the game is shored up. We really don't know yet. And again, I don't have a problem with the game planning or anything like that or Aller's reads to this point, but you do, I certainly think that Penn State is going to need more than two receivers and a tight end to make some plays in the passing game if this team is going to be one of the final four standing, let's say, at the end of the year.
And I agree with that, Jeff, but I'm also okay with where they ended up, because our big issue last year was no explosive plays. Guess what? We're getting explosive plays, and we're getting them from the running game also, which I want to hit in a second. But here's another little fun fact for you. In these two games, do you know how many times Tyler Warren was targeted?
11?
11. Do you know how many completions?
Was it all 11, I think?
It was. I'm not going to have an issue with that.
I hear you.
And so if you're 11 for 11 for, I think it's like 160, 170 yards, I'm very okay with that. And the disparity of, you know, Trey Wallace from the first game to the second game, I think I'm okay with that also, because it was, again, so few passes were thrown. I think you got to aggregate the two games to get kind of a feel for the distribution.
Yeah, and listen, if you have a mismatch and you can take advantage of it, and clearly Tyler Warren was a very difficult matchup for Bowling Green, and Trey Wallace was a very difficult matchup for West Virginia. If you have something that's working and it's available, like, you don't just, well, we want to get these other guys involved, so let's not take advantage of, hey, I see Trey Wallace is open again, but I want to get these other guys involved. Well, no, that's silly. So again, I have zero qualms with the way the offense has operated through the first two games, but we just don't know yet what we have in terms of the consistency with the receiving core. And at some point, that's going to have to show up and show up in a positive way, again, for Penn State to get where it wants to be. But again, you don't need to force it, and I don't have any problem with the way things have played out here in that regard through the first two games. We talked all preseason. I thought Tyler Warren was going to be as big a weapon as Penn State had, and you'd be crazy not to utilize it. And so they have certainly utilized it, and it makes a ton of sense to do that. And Nicholas Singleton has gotten off to the type of start that I thought he would with this Andy Kotelnicki offense, and that is certainly another very positive sign, seeing both Singleton and Allen go over 100 in that game Saturday, regardless of the opponent, is not insignificant to me in terms of, again, laying the groundwork for what this offense needs to become as the season plays out for Penn State to become a legitimate contender here in the playoffs.
And Jeff, the thing with Singleton and Allen, you love the Nick Singleton 40-yard runs, obviously. What I liked is in this Bowling Green game, combined, Katron Allen, Nick Singleton had 8 rushes of at least 10 yards.
Yeah. No, and that's huge, again, for getting this offense to where it wants to be and allowing this team to be where it wants to be. And the other thing I'll throw in, because it was a big question mark, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you now I have 100% confidence, no matter where they're out in the field, that Sandra Sahadak is going to come through. But I have a lot more confidence now than I did going into that Bowling Green game. And we kind of were joking that it didn't necessarily want to see him out there, but he hit both, and it looked solid. And again, I think every time he is out there and gets it through the uprights, it's another confidence builder for him, but also a confidence builder for the coaches and the team to believe in him and what he can achieve, which again, I feel like, you know, at some point there's going to be a clutch field goal that Penn State has to have. And I certainly feel better about their ability to get those 3 points when they need it now than I did coming out of the West Virginia game.
And Jeff, you could call me crazy if you want, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to compliment James Franklin again. How's
what
that?
What is the matter with you, Jim?
I know. A little, you know, I'm a little off this week. But did James Franklin not tell us last week how confident he was in Sander Sahadek?
Yeah.
And a lot of people I know scoffed at it. They already had him benched after one miss. And he didn't just make those field goals. They were crisp.
Yes.
They were perfect. He crushed them.
He did. And hit them with authority. And, you know, I will say the one thing, I think it was big for him to do that, because it's great that Franklin has confidence in him, and it's great that presumably he has confidence in himself. But after the start to last season and the way that played out, and then missing the first one, if he misses another one or two there against Bowling Green, you can't help but think that starts to play on your mind. Whereas now it's, you get those two under your belt, it's like, oh yeah, no, this is what. Now it's easier to say, yep, the confidence is there both ways. I just, hitting them in a game is different, and getting that experience and the confidence under your belt, I think, is really big moving forward.
It was, but that's going to be the final word. Thank you all for listening. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.